Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Pregnancy Discrimination and Employment Accommodation Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 3, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Young v. United Parcel Service. This case concerns whether and in what circumstances the Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires an employer that provides work accommodations to employees who are not pregnant but have work limitations to provide work accommodations to pregnant employees who share similar abilities and limitations. To discuss the case, we have Teresa Collette, who is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Collette.
The United States Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments in the case of Young versus UPS. This case involves the proper interpretation of the second operative clause of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, an act that was passed prior to the Americans with Disabilities Act. At issue in the case is whether or not a company must accommodate pregnancy in the same manner that it accommodates other limitations on the ability to work, independent of the source of those limitations and independent of the general prohibition against sex-based discrimination. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act, in its first prong, clearly incorporates pregnancy as a form of sex-based discrimination. That was not at issue in this case. The trial court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, as well as the petitioner in the case, agreed that this was not a case in which animus had been shown by the employer toward the condition of pregnancy. Instead, what was at issue was what it means in the second prong of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to require that an employee be treated based on her ability or inability to work, independent of the fact that she's pregnant. In this particular case, United Postal Service had an employee who, under its employment agreement, was required to be able to lift and deliver packages weighing up to 70 pounds. Peggy Young, after multiple attempts to become pregnant, succeeded and received a doctor's note saying that she should not lift packages weighing more than 20 pounds. The interesting factual point in Peggy Young's particular case is that her delivery route for UPS was from the airport and involved primarily, almost exclusively, the delivery of light business packages, the sort of mailings that lawyers are very familiar with, documents for closings or public offerings. And therefore, according to the trial court, the vast majority of deliveries that Peggy Young would be required to make would not weigh more than 20 pounds. However, notwithstanding this fact, there were rare occasions in which she would be required to lift more than 70 pounds. She had proposed to UPS that those packages be delivered by another driver who had volunteered to do so on her behalf. UPS, an employer who, rightfully being concerned about having to alter routes, liability, etc., had declined that and had made the decision based on its existing policy that they would accommodate limitations on the ability to work only in three cases. Those three cases were, first, if the limitation arose from an injury that occurred while on the job. Second, if the limitation was related to the loss of a Department of Transportation driving's license. Or third, if the limitation was encompassed by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Given that pregnancy falls into none of these categories, the question then becomes, what does the Pregnancy Discrimination Act mean when it says that employers must treat the pregnant employee, independent of her pregnancy, the same as other employees based on her ability or inability to work? It is indisputed that UPS had been confronted with what the court referred to as light duty in multiple instances. In other words, other employees had presented UPS with requests for limitations on their obligations based on an inability to lift more than 20 pounds. But in this particular case, UPS had distinguished among all of those employees who had lifting limitations based on its three criteria. Was the employee's limitation based on an injury on the job? Here, clearly not. What did it result in? Some suspension or loss of Department of Transportation driving privileges? Again, clearly not. And finally, was it a limitation based on a condition that would be covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act? Again, here, clearly not. The company therefore argued that because Peggy Young was treated no differently than any other employee who had a lifting limitation that arose outside those three circumstances, they could not have violated the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Peggy Young's counsel and the Solicitor General argued that in this particular instance, the proper comparison are not those individuals who have limitations arising outside of the exceptions the company recognized, but whether the company provided any exceptions at all. The argument basically was, once a company chose to accommodate limitations that were similar in their impact on an employee's ability or inability to work, then pregnancy must be included in that accommodation. The court was very active in the argument, and it centered upon how to interpret the second clause in such a way that was consistent with legislative intent. Justice Scalia early on weighed in, suggesting that Peggy Young's argument basically was that pregnancy must be treated as a most favored nation status, no matter how many accommodations had been offered by the company based on other facts or circumstances. The counsel for Peggy Young argued that that, in fact, would be dependent in part upon the nature of the accommodations and the reason for those accommodations. He argued that the company could not disqualify pregnant women's request for accommodation simply on the basis of the source of the limitation. But then Justice Kennedy intervened, asking exactly then what criteria should we use? How do we distinguish between the various requests for accommodation? It became clear that the court was concerned about how this particular proposed interpretation would fit within the general employee discrimination context. McDonnell-Douglas test and disparate impact was one of the suggestions that Justice Breyer made. In fact, he argued that that would have been the perfect case. But Peggy Young had made the decision early on that this case would be cast not as disparate impact, but rather as disparate treatment. Justice Ginsburg seemed fully in favor of recognizing that pregnancy should be treated as a condition that gave rise to limitations, that where any accommodation was made, pregnancy should be included. She accused Justice Scalia of trying to establish pregnancy as the least favored nation. General Verrilli, in an unusual turn of events, seemed to make the most clear-cut argument based on statutory construction. He proposed that the statute should be read to read effectively that a pregnant woman should be compared with other workers having non-pregnancy-related medical conditions that impose comparable limitations. The problem with this suggestion is that it doesn't advance the argument much. It is beyond question that UPS provided accommodations for those who had lifting limitations and, in other cases, refused accommodation. The question is, when a company accommodates some workers that have comparable ability to work, while not accommodating other non-pregnant workers with comparable ability or inability to work. What does the statute require? At the end of the day, it appears that it will come down to whether or not the justices are persuaded that the legislative history of this act intended to provide women the opportunity to keep working in circumstances where other employees, regardless of the source of their limitations and the duration of these limitations, were allowed to keep working. If that's the case, then Peggy Young will prevail. If the court, however, finds that the legislative history indicates that, as many lower court rulings have held, that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act did not intend to effectuate a general change in the employer's obligation to treat those who have limitations that go to their ability to work, and therefore impose no additional obligations, then Peggy Young will lose. A third option, and perhaps the most likely option where you have a deeply divided court, as it appears we will based on oral argument, is to simply say that because this case was disposed of at summary judgment, that it should be remanded and returned for trial to determine what other employees who had requested lifting limitations had not received them, and what was the source of their limitations and what other circumstances surrounded their request. Many of the questions toward the end of the oral argument seemed to focus on the factual record, which, because it was on summary judgment, was not well developed. The court seemed to give little credence to the fact that the EEOC had, in 2014, issued regulations that would support the position of the plaintiff. Nor was there any discussion of the fact that UPS, in the midst of this litigation, has determined that going forward, their policy in the future will be indeed to accommodate women who are pregnant if their limitation is the same as other employees who receive accommodations under their three exceptions of a disability arising that is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, a limitation arising from an on-the-job injury, or a limitation that has affected the Department of Transportation driving privileges. In the end, Peggy Young has won her personal vindication, but the case will answer for the rest of us, the employers throughout the nation, the question of when an employer chooses to voluntarily create an accommodation based on a particular limitation of an employee, do pregnant women get included by virtue of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act?
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.